Great. So I'm going to read from the passage that you've got on your sheet in front of you, Hebrews 2, verses 5 to 9. Now, it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honour, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him, but we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honour because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you, Claire. Do keep that in front of you. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be human? Big question, isn't it, for a Wednesday lunchtime? Shakespeare's words from the mouth of Hamlet are perhaps very fitting. Sorry I'm not Benedict Cumberbatch, but this is the best I can do. What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And it's true, isn't it? We have amazing faculties, even if not quite infinite. We develop incredible technology, marvelous medical care that can cure diseases that years ago would have killed people. And yet, there's something wrong with us, isn't there? I'm sure if we're honest, none of us are the people we want to be. Maybe you've made some New Year's resolutions. To be honest, I haven't. There's no point, because I've always broken them after about 2 weeks. If I could keep going to the 6th of January, that would be great. We're not the people we feel we should be. And the world somehow isn't what we think it should be either, is it? There are so many things around us that despite our technology, despite our infinite faculties, as Shakespeare puts it, we cannot control. I'm sure we've all seen the terrible scenes on our televisions over Christmas of the floods in various parts of this country and indeed over in America as well, in St. Louis, the city I used to live in. Floods causing devastation. We're not quite able to control it, are we? And yet there's a feeling that we should be able to control things. We should be able to do better. And that's a lot of the stuff in the press about the government not spending enough money on flood defences. Now, that may or may not be true, but behind that is an assumption that we should be able to control the natural world. We should be able to make it more hospitable than it is. That there must be some solution. Well, is there a solution? What could it take to make the world more hospitable? What could it take for us to be the people we feel like we could be and not the failures we often end up being? Well, the writer to the Hebrews is giving us an answer to that question. He's giving us a bit of the Bible's answer to those questions. He is writing about what he's called this great salvation. We had the bit earlier. That's how he refers to what he's talking about here, this great salvation. Now, salvation is not the same as salvaging. If a car gets wrecked on the road, someone might salvage it and kind of get it back and use it as scrap metal. Salvation is something much bigger. It's about restoring something that is broken and marred and making it not just as good as new, but even better than new. And that's what this writer is talking about here in these verses we have before us. He's talking about a great rescue package in which human beings can be rescued, in which the whole world can be rescued to make it better than new. And he tells us in Hebrews chapter 2, which we're going to look at over the next few weeks, that for that to happen, God had to become a man. God had to become a man and had to do what we failed to do. In fact, in the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at three different images the writer uses. It's like a great sports producer using different camera angles to show us the whole action. And so he gives us three different angles on the person and work of Jesus of Nazareth, of who he is and what his life, death, and resurrection achieved. And he's writing this to a group of Christian believers in the first century who were thinking about giving up on their faith. He's writing to them to urge them to keep believing in Jesus. But they were tempted to not believe in him. They were tempted to give up for a number of reasons. Firstly, they wanted to go back to their Jewish origins. That seemed to them to be an equally valid route to God. And also they felt Judaism perhaps offered them a more authentic experience. After all, it had a temple that still operated at that time. It had sacrifices. It had religious traditions. It seemed more authentic to them. And perhaps also they wanted to go back to it because it seemed like an easier option. If you read through the whole book of Hebrews, you'd find that some of these people had faced imprisonment, they'd had their possessions confiscated. It was a hard thing following Jesus Christ. In contrast, in first century Roman Empire, Judaism was a licensed religion. So Jews could get on and be Jews and had sort of permission to do that, whereas to be a Christian was a harder call indeed. And so this writer is writing to them to say, look, Christianity is not equally valid with Judaism. It is the truth, it is the thing you need to hold on to. And I wonder if sitting here today, some of you have some of the same thoughts that those original readers had. That maybe this is just one truth among many. Maybe there are other ways I could have a more authentic experience, more authentic meaning to life. Or maybe there are other things that just be an easier option. Christianity can seem so demanding at times. Why take this too seriously? Too inconvenient to do that. Well, let's look at what this writer writes. Let's look at this great rescue passage. And there's some notes there on the sheet to help you follow through. Because as he explains what this world to come, what this great salvation looks like, the writer tells us three things. He tells us about the way the world was supposed to be, the way the world is, and the way the world will be restored forever. So let's look at those briefly. First of all, he reminds us of the way the world was meant to be. And those words you've got there that are kind of indented in poetry form, they're a quote from an Old Testament hymn, from Psalm 8 in the Old Testament. It's a song the Jews would have sung in the temple to praise God. It was a song that praised God for the way he'd made the universe. And particularly it praised God for his the amazing privilege he's bestowed on human beings. You can see that in the verse 6 there. What is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him? In this great huge universe, why do you care about us little creatures? The psalmist is saying. You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor. You put everything in subjection under his feet. That's really a song celebrating the story we read of right back in the start of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, where God made the whole world, he made it good, and the high point of creation was making man and woman in the image of God. Now, in the ancient world, emperors and rulers would put up statues, images of themselves, all around their territories. It's a way of saying, I'm in charge here, I'm the ruler here. In far-off parts of their empires, their people would never have seen them. And it's that kind of idea here, that God makes human beings in his image as to be his rulers in his world he made, to represent him, to rule as his vice-regents on his behalf, and to rule under his authority in a way that showed his character, what his good rule, his kind, good ways of ruling are. So that was the way the world was meant to be. And it was good. It was very good, we read at the end of Genesis 1. But that is not the way the world is it? And this writer to the Hebrews acknowledges that. At the end of verse 8, he says, at present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. In other words, we don't see mankind ruling over a world that works. And that's so obvious, isn't it? We see floods, we see disease, we see death, we see depression, we see all these things that cause us grief. The world now is not in subjection under human rule. It is out of control. It's like a runaway train that cannot be stopped. So what went wrong? Why is the world the way it is? Well, the writer doesn't tell us here because his readers would know, because they knew the story. They knew how in the beginning God had made this beautiful world. He'd planted a garden for his first people, Adam and Eve. He put beautiful fruit trees in it. And he said, go, have fun. You can eat almost anything in this garden. You can eat from any tree apart from one. I want you to enjoy what I've made. I want you to fill this world. I want you to go and invent culture. Be artistic. Create things. Go and investigate the world I've made. Develop science. Develop technology. Start up businesses. Fill this world under my rule. Enjoy it. I've made it for you. There's just one thing. You can eat all the beautiful fruit I've made in this garden. But there's just one tree here in the middle where you must not eat the fruit. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And you cannot eat of that because it's not for you to determine good and evil. I am God, you are my creatures. You cannot live without me. You cannot live as if you can make up the rules yourselves. If you don't eat from that tree, you'll be fine and happy and great. If you do eat from it, you will die. And that makes sense, doesn't it? If you cut a branch off from a tree, it dies, doesn't it? Because you cut it off from its the root of its life, the source of its life. And so human beings were warned there back in the garden that if they tried to live without God, if they tried to cut themselves off from God, they would die. It was a natural consequence as well as a punishment for rebelling against God. And yet, that is exactly what they did. And the result, as God promised, was death. The punishment for their rebellion. And that's death in its fullest sense. Not just physical death, terrible as that is, but also spiritual death. So we're cut off from the God we are created to know and enjoy. And as a result, everything unravels. This good creation now unravels. Instead of working properly under human rule, it now rebels against us, in a sense, the way we rebelled against God. And so we find the world is not in subjection under us. Rather, we are subject to natural forces, to viruses, to disease, to depression, to floods which we cannot cope with. We cannot stop this runaway train and get creation back under control. No matter how much technology we come up with, no matter how many billions of pounds are invested, we cannot do it. We cannot undo the damage we've done. And so we need the great rescue package. And so thirdly, the writer tells us not only about the way the world is supposed to be and the way the world is, but he describes the way the world will be restored forever. You can see that in verse 9, the last verse on the sheet. And there are three stages we read in verse 9. There's humiliation, coronation, and a final victory. Humiliation, coronation, and a final victory. Let me get to the humiliation stage first. Some things can only be fixed from the inside. There was a film a few years ago. It's actually the last time I went to the cinema, I think. 5 years ago. With children now, I just never get to go. If my wife and I could get a babysitter, we'd go and talk to each other rather than watch a film. Anyway, so the last film I saw was a film called Unstoppable, which was actually quite missable, really. But for those of you who don't know the story, it stars Denzel Washington and a guy called Chris Pine. And the story goes that some engineers on a train line were working on some trains. They took some shortcuts. They didn't do what they're supposed to do because they couldn't really be bothered. And as a result, a train left the yard on full power with no brakes. And it was a train carrying a whole load of toxic cargo. So it couldn't just be simply derailed. It had to be stopped somehow. And of course, in great Hollywood style, as the story goes on, it's all quite gripping. And they tried to do various things. They can't stop it at all. And at the end, the only way to actually stop it is Chris Pine on the back of the pickup truck is driven along alongside it, jumps into the train cabin, gets in, and can finally stop this train and bring it under control. The problem caused by human negligence and rebellion could only be solved by another human coming on the inside and taking control. And that is a little picture, inadequate as it is, of what Jesus Christ has done. And we see that beginning in the humiliation here. Verse 9, we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus. Back in chapter 1, the writer to the Hebrews had described the Son of God as being the heir of all things, the one through whom everything was created. Now this one who is worshipped by the angels is humiliated. He steps down, he comes in low to fix the trouble we caused. The Creator turns up on earth as a gardener. It's a bigger change than the CEO going to clean the toilets, and the chief financial officer suddenly becoming a night security guard. It is a huge humiliation. He steps down. A few years ago at Christmas time, Prince William spent a night on the streets, I think under Waterloo Bridge probably, with homeless people to identify with them, to understand them. And it's a great thing he did. It's a tremendous thing he did. But it's small fry compared to what the Son of God did. He didn't come for a night. He didn't even come just for 30 years, but all the way from Bethlehem to his death on the cross, to his resurrection, to now on high. He became a human being. He became a true man to fix what we'd broken. And you can see what he went through in that humiliation. At the end of verse 9, he was able so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Remember, death is not natural in God's world. Death is the consequence, the punishment for human beings rejecting God and trying to live as if he didn't exist or we didn't need him. Yet Jesus Christ, the only true human who ever lived, the one who always lived in perfect relationship with God, tasted death so we didn't have to. And he does that by the grace of God the Father. It's not like the Son dies to persuade an angry, malevolent God to start to be kind. No, it is all part of the rescue package designed by the triune God, God the Father, Son, and Spirit, to restore us and to give us a new future and greater destiny. So that's the first stage of the rescue package, this humiliation of the Son of God, Jesus being made lower than the angels. But then there's coronation. Verse 9. We see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death. Because he has broken death, because he has taken death for us, he is now crowned and rules over the universe in a way that humans were supposed to do originally. Adam and Eve, the first humans, were crowned with glory and honor as being made in God's image, being made as rulers in his world. But they lost that crown through their rejection of God's ways. As humans, we still wear, to borrow a phrase from Tolkien, we still wear the rags of lordship. You can still see there's something good and profound about us, which could be great. And yet we are glorious ruins. But Jesus now, as the true man, wears the crown. Now, how do we know he's been crowned? How do we know? Is that just Christian wishful thinking? No, the story of the New Testament is we know he is crowned with glory and honor because his tomb is empty. Because he has been raised to life again. Philip asked me earlier what things convince me about the gospel. And I didn't say it earlier, but one of the things that convinces me is I see no better explanation for the events after Jesus' death than actually that he did physically rise from the dead. And so is now crowned with glory and honor. Do you feel free to ask me about that later if you've got time. So there's humiliation, coronation. But there's also final triumph, which is actually mentioned at the end of verse 8. He left nothing outside his control. In putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. Now, that's not true for most humans now. It is true for Jesus Christ, the true human. But when will that final triumph be evident? Because we don't see it today, do we? Well, the story of the Bible goes on and tells us it will be evident when this man, this God-man Jesus, returns as the judge of all the world. For all the people who have ever lived. And for all who've turned from living their own way, as if God was irrelevant or didn't exist, for all who've turned from that life to turn to Jesus and trust him, they will get to enjoy the glory and honor that Jesus now enjoys. But for those who don't, there will be judgment. So here is the rescue package: humiliation, coronation, final victory. Humiliation is past. The coronation is now. Jesus is reigning. The final victory, the final triumph, is still to come. We live in a time waiting for that. But so what? How is that good news to people who've just had their homes flooded? How is it good news for the lady whose funeral of whose husband I attended a couple of weeks ago? How is it good news for perhaps people here struggling with depression or stress of work or broken relationships or broken dreams? Let me very quickly give you four implications of this great rescue package, which are there on your sheet. Firstly, there is one thing we can never say. There's one thing we can never say. People often will say, if God really loved us, wouldn't the world be better? If God cared, wouldn't he do something? Well, we can never say God doesn't care, because God has come in person to deal with the problem, to fix it from the inside. Here's how Dorothy L. Sayers, a crime writer of the last century, put it. The incarnation, she writes, God becoming flesh, means that for whatever reason God chose to let us fall into suffering and to be subject to sorrows and death, he nonetheless had the honesty and the courage to take his own medicine. He himself has gone through the whole of human experience, from the trivial irritations of family life and the cramping restrictions of hard work and lack of money, to the worst horrors of pain, humiliation, defeat, despair, and death. He was born in poverty and suffered infinite pain, all for us, and thought it well worth his while. We can never say God doesn't care, even if we do not understand. There's one thing we can never expect as well. We can never expect a perfect world now. As the writer here puts it in verse 8, at present we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. We cannot have a perfect world now. And yet so often we think we should, don't we? We think if we go on holiday and get a good holiday, we'll be refreshed and feel great again. How many of you honestly feel refreshed after Christmas and New Year? Exactly. You take my point? Or we expect that the promotion or a good bonus will make our work fulfilling and make us feel fulfilled. Yet it doesn't happen. And so much unhappiness in our lives becomes from expecting too much. We cannot expect the world to be perfect. We're not perfect ourselves. We cannot expect other people or the world to be perfect. But there is, thirdly, one thing we can have if we embrace this rescue package. We can have hope. We can have hope because Jesus is crowned with glory and honor, because he is ruling, and because one day he will return. And please understand, this hope is not wishful thinking. I hope Scotland will do really well in the Six Nations rugby coming up. It hasn't happened for a long time. That's just wishful thinking. This is based on reality. It's based on what God has done in history in the person of Jesus Christ. Neither is this hope just warm, fuzzy feelings. It's not like Buddhism, for example, with the hope of nirvana, that one day we'll just sort of go blend into the great oneness. This is a real solid hope, a hope of a new creation, a new world where we will be the people God intended us to be, and the world will work as it should work, without death or mourning or crying or pain. Now those implications lead to one fourth and final implication very briefly. That is, there is one choice we need to make. There is one choice we need to make. We need to choose whether we're going to embrace this rescue package, believe that Jesus is God on earth, come to be the true man who did what no human being has ever been able to do to restore us. Or we can keep living our own way, keep finding our own solutions, none of which will work. This letter was written to people who thought that there might be another valid option out there. The writer says, no, there is Jesus and no other hope. It's written to people who found Christianity was a bit hard and inconvenient. The writer says, don't worry about that. Jesus knows inconvenience and hardship. And we'll see that in weeks to come. And this writer is showing us that Christianity is not about what we do. It is about what God has done. No religion, no philosophy deals with the fundamental problem of our rebellion against God. No other worldview shows us that God cares as much as Christianity does. So the question is, will you embrace this offer? Will you continue to embrace it? Or will you look for your own solution? Let me pray briefly as you head back to work. Almighty God, we thank you that you care so much. You came in the person of your Son to stop this runaway train, to restore us to true humanity in Jesus Christ. Grant us faith and perseverance to believe and understand and enjoy. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.